Good evening and welcome to Outsources. On KGNU, I'm Yvonne Crumry, and tonight I'm speaking with Alok, performance artist and writer, who was slated to keynote for the Transforming Gender Conference this past month, which was then postponed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Due to the nature of a long-distance interview, I'd like to acknowledge that the audio quality of this show comes in and out as it was a phone call. So at times, it may be a little harder to hear our guests and what they're saying. Thank you for bearing with me.
Can I go ahead and start by asking you to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Alok. I'm a gender nonconforming writer and performance artist based out of New York City. I use poetry, fashion, design, comedy, and performance as a way to explore themes of race, gender, but I also think trauma, emotions, and the human condition. And I have a book coming out in June that I'm starting to talk about called Beyond the Gender Binary, and that was going to be the keynote presentation that I was giving at the Trans Conference in Boulder this weekend.
I'm wondering, do you want to share any kind of highlights to look forward to about that or reasons to pre-order?
Sure. So the reason I'm really excited about this book in particular is I feel like a lot of the information and gender theory is really academic and inaccessible to the public. And so I sought the opportunity to publish through a youth press for a couple of reasons. The first being that in 2020, there's already been 12 states that are trying to pass bills that are specifically targeting trans young people. So, for example, today in Alabama, the Senate is passing, or I think it was on March 5th, actually, a bill that would try to punish doctors for giving hormone blockers to trans kids by a sentence of up to 10 years in prison. And this follows a campaign in Idaho to throw doctors for a life sentence in prison for this. And so working with the Teenage Press was really important to me because I wanted to get this book in the hands of young people so that they could respond to the kinds of arguments that are being used against their dignity every day. But then also because I just wanted to create a resource that would be accessible by a wider public. Because I think one of the things facing trans and non-binary people especially is that we're often accused of just making it up. And that's because people just don't have access to comprehensive education about our history and our issues. And the reason I'm really pushing the pre-order sort of campaign, the book is coming out on June 2nd, but the reason I'm encouraging people to pre-order is that I really am working now to create an infrastructure where allies can purchase books in solidarity with trans youth. So it's really important to me to get these books and this knowledge to places that really need it, because I understand one of the biggest issues in this country is that ignorance is organized, like, and it's well-funded, and people just don't have basic access to education about themselves and about the world, and that oftentimes the people who could most benefit from the education are systematically denied it. And so if we're able to show the publisher that there's a lot of demand for this, they'll print more copies, and it kind of becomes a feedback loop. And for me, it's really important about getting this to places that people wouldn't normally think of as a place where we need to be talking about, like Wyoming and Idaho and North Dakota and Alaska are all places where trans young people are experiencing incredibly high rates of suicide and repression. And I think that one of the ways that we counter that injustice, and in particular that kind of ambient suicidality facing the trans community, is just by visible displays of solidarity like this. And so in this book, what I do is I address the main arguments that people are using against trans people and provide interventions and responses that are clear and politically informed. And I think everyone, regardless of their age, could benefit from that.
I want to continue by asking, how did you start your journey to doing this work?
Let's see. I think there are many stories that I could say about that, but one that feels really timely, especially as I'm thinking about doing promotion for this book, is as As a young person, I grew up in a small and conservative town in Texas where I didn't have access to in-person community, and I didn't really have any places that were giving me information about people like me. I just fundamentally thought that living a trans life would be impossible and lethal. And so I actively sought information, and I was, like so many young queer and trans youth, really proactive in my Googling and my initial social mediaing, which was like very LiveJournal and MySpace back in my day. And I realized at that young age how much power comes and how much possibility comes from access to knowledge, because I wasn't learning things in school. In Texas, where I grew up, it was a zero tolerance policy. Like, we were just forcibly denied access to information about our bodies and our experiences and our lives. And when I found information online and when I found information in books, it gave me permission to exist as a person. And that relationship between knowledge and existence is really intimate to me as an activist and as an artist, is that I still feel like so many of us don't have permission to be. And so I think that a lot of the work that I've come into and what I'm trying to do is to actually tell people that the lives that they're living are legitimate lives, and to challenge the standards of legitimacy that have been upheld by systems, in particular patriarchy. And that's a core belief that I carry into my entire artistic practice. Is people always say you should dress a certain way to be taken seriously, and I want to challenge why my appearance is linked to my credibility to begin with. People always say that you have to speak a certain way in order to be regarded, and I want to challenge whose standards of speaking are we required to adopt. So I guess a long-winded way of saying so much of what I'm doing now is a direct result of, as a young person, coming to a deeper appreciation of how liberatory education could be. And I think especially thinking about what's happening right now, the Democratic primaries, and what's happening in political conversations in this country, we need to be very clear in saying education should not be a luxury, that education should be a fundamental right for all people.
Okay, yes, thank you. One piece that you recently put out that I really appreciated personally was your CNN op-ed, It's Time for a New Beauty Paradigm, which recentered the idea of fashion and beauty in terms of self-actualization and self-love. And like I said, this piece really impacted me. Can you tell us about your experience reckoning with beauty standards and beauty industries?
Totally. So I think for a long time, I felt like insecure about entering the beauty industry because of my own internalization of sexism and misogyny. So then I started to really think about this theme of beauty, and actually beauty is a current of every system of oppression. Racism justifies itself by saying that to be lighter skin is to be beautiful. Ableism justifies itself because in the United States there were a series of laws in the 20th century and some times the 19th century that were colloquially referred to as the ugly laws, which essentially banned people with physical disabilities from existing in public because they were seen as too unsightly. So much violence against marginalized people is often justified in the name of you are not beautiful and therefore you are not worthy. And so I began to realize that beauty is fundamentally linked to worth. And what I was trying to do in that op-ed is I just really feel like the ways that we've been taught beauty reproduce systems of violence that will always leave us feeling inadequate and like we're not enough, and that we have to aspire to be something that we're not in order to be beautiful. And my meaning and my intention behind beauty is not that we should give up on beauty, because I think beauty is really powerful. The way that I've survived is that I breathe air and I think, wow, isn't nature beautiful? I look outside at the people around me and I say, wow, like, isn't there so much beauty and diversity? Like, that's what keeps me going. So I don't want to give up on beauty, but I want to redefine beauty. And when I say beauty is about being yourself, what I actually mean is that there are infinite forms of beauty. And I think that's something that I never was taught, because I was taught that there's only one way to be beautiful. And I actually now am learning and unlearning that there's many ways to be beautiful as there are people. And that actually actually the goal of so many of, like, political consciousness is about being able to see the infinite interiority and complexity of one another. And what I mean by that is, like, we're incentivized and primed to look at each other and just make so many aggressive assumptions about one another and to collapse people into, like, categories. But I think, actually, a commitment to beauty looks like taking someone out for, like, 5 hours and listening to their story and finding beauty in that story. And beauty for me is not just about the body or what we look like. It's also about our energy and how we make people feel. And so I think that that kind of recalibration of beauty has been so foundational to both my survival, because I felt that I deserved the violence that was happening to me when I was younger because I felt like I was ugly. And even before I had the language of politics or of, like, race or gender, I had the feeling of being told that I was ugly. And I want to, I guess, create a world where no one ever has to feel that. Because in order for beauty to exist as it does right now, there have to be people who feel ugly. And what I want in the future is a breakout of that ugly beauty binary and a recognition that all of us are beautiful no matter what we look like.
Wow. That's something to sit with. Thank you. I think one question I have, and you've already touched on some recommendations for moving forward with this concept, but what advice do you have for young queer and trans people who struggle to see the beauty in themselves?
I think that that's one of the hardest things in the world because it so often defies, like, reason. Like, people will, in our lives, will say to us, you're amazing, you're beautiful, and yet we always feel lack. And feeling lack is one of the most painful feelings in the world because it feels like you're impossible. And I think impossibility is a feeling. And so I think that what I've really done in my life is I don't want to play pretend and be like, every day I wake up and I just have radical self-acceptance and I'm confident and buoyant. Like, that's just not true. There are tough days all the time. But I think that what I'm really trying to do is to surround myself with people who are committed to a different world and a different way of relating to each other, and to separate myself from institutions and media platforms that are actually toxic for me. So, like, one tangible thing this can look like is, like, literally just unfollowing people on social media who make you feel insecure or shame about your body and your experiences, and actually, like, creating and consuming media that with people who look like you and that affirm you. And I think that's one of the best parts of the digital revolution is that there's so many incredible content creators who are creating robust and diverse content that is not mainstream and that can replicate our actual lives. So I think media filtration is really important. I think, like, where we spend time, the friends that we have, cutting out toxic relationships is really important. And then I also think that the third thing, and this is something that I'm just starting to do myself, is developing a relationship with our spirituality. And spirituality for me is not just religion. Spirituality for me is actually about trying to find a greater purpose to ourselves and into life. And I think that for me, for a long time, I put a lot of my self-worth in what other people said about me or thought about me. And I think that propelled so much of my first years as a public figure, as I really wanted to be validated because I wasn't validated by my family or my community growing up. So I was like, oh, if people say I'm smart or if people say I'm successful, then maybe I'll be smart and successful. And then I realized that didn't work, that you can have millions of people say to you that you're amazing and you still won't feel it. But when you begin to feel it is when you actually develop a relationship with yourself. And so now what I tell people is that when people ask me who I'm dating, I'm like, myself. Like, I actually feel like my relationship with myself is my deepest and most prolonged romance in the world. And it's heartbreaking, and we, like, run after each other on beaches, and we're trying to figure it out. But spirituality for me is about self-relationality and being able to sit with yourself, being able to adore yourself, being able to treat yourself, being able to be in your stillness and to find infinite wisdom in that quiet. And I just think that so much serenity can come from surrendering to the fact that within ourselves, there are entire eons to explore over our entire life.
You're listening to Outsources on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm Yvonne Crumery, and I've been speaking with Alok, performance artist and writer who was slated to be our keynote speaker for the now-postponed Transforming Gender Conference. We've been discussing their new book, Beyond the Gender Binary, and their recent work on redefining beauty in the beauty industry.
To kind of segue to more of conversations around lack again, in an interview that I watched with you, you once said, "We call people strong and inspirational and brave so that we can be lazy and not actually stop the issues that they're facing." Is this something you continue to encounter in the ally spaces and in ally communities?
100%. I really hate the language of strength. And I see the ways that we reproduce it over and over again, being like, "We're going to get through this. We're strong." Like, whenever there's tragedy or violence, we say we're strong. And I just don't think that that's the correct response. I think the correct response is to be like, we are actually hurting. We are in pain. We are fragile. We are insecure. We are scared. We're sad. Now what do we do? Because when we accept and admit frailty, we create the conditions for possibility. When we say that we're strong and empowered, we enclose those conditions. And we basically say, I can figure it out. I'm self-knowing. I'm self-contained. But frailty creates vulnerability, which creates interdependence. And so I think that what I really would ask people to tell one another is, it's okay if you're not strong. It's okay if you're grieving. It's okay if you don't think you're going to get over someone in your life dying, or you don't think that you're ever going to feel beautiful, that I'm still going to care about you even then. Because I think that right now, oftentimes, allyship is contingent on resilience. Meaning we require people who are enduring profound forms of aggression and torture to go through it and then romanticize their suffering after the fact, to be like, I'm glad that that pain taught me who I am. I'm like, no, we shouldn't have to go through pain. Like, we shouldn't have to normalize that or standardize that. And we should be deeply sad that that's the world that we live in. I want people to just be able to exist and for their existence to not be a threat. And I think a lot of times when people hear me speak about this, they'll be like, well, you know, strength can be important. And I'm not giving up on that. Like, I think that sometimes we do need to feel strength. We do need to feel empowerment. But what I'm questioning is how easy it is to compliment people versus how difficult it is to actually shift the conditions that require people to have to be resilient to begin with. So in a tangible example of this around trans issues, I noticed that so many trans people, and especially trans feminine people, are told that we are, like, so fierce. And I'm like, do you understand that the reason that I'm this fierce is because I have to endure so much violence that I had to develop a thick skin in order, like, this was my coping strategy. And I think, who can I be? Like, what could I look like? What could I be doing if I didn't have to think about violence? So rather than just complimenting me, I think it's the exclusivity of just complimenting me without also fighting to hold the people who are being violent to me accountable, because they often get left unprovoked.
And so in that same line, talking about accountability and creating actual action and change, I have a question from the staff of Out Boulder who were helping with the conference, and they were excited that I was talking to you. They asked, how can white-led organizations better help bring our communities together?
Right. I think that's a really important conversation, especially when we're talking about trans and gender nonconforming issues. Because what many people don't recognize is that the reason that we have such a strict reliance on the gender binary, or the idea that there's a man and a woman, and that those are the only two ways of existing, is because these were cultural imports and impositions onto people of color and indigenous peoples, especially in what is now called the United States. But across indigenous societies across the world, there was actually a much more sophisticated and complex system of gender that was literally criminalized and faced attempted cultural genocide to replace it with this white binary, this white Western binary. And so oftentimes we forget that the reason that trans people experience persecution in this country, even if they're white, is because of that legacy of colonization. And so that's why Black, Indigenous, and POC trans people experience the brunt of the violence, is it's because transphobia is a system of racism. And so I think it's first an acknowledgement of that and all programming around gender. It's not enough to just talk about transphobia without talking about racism. And it's really important to recognize that the trans struggle and trans movement has to always make partnerships with the racial justice movement. And that this distinction of like a women's issue or an LGBT issue from race is wrong, because actually racial justice is gender justice. Gender justice is racial justice. Then second, I think it's about creating avenues for leadership of the people who are most directly impacted. So it's not enough for trans people of color to be talking points. There have to be actually plans within the organization and within the group of how do we amplify the leadership of trans people of color. And so this looks like is creating pathways where people can get access to the training, to the education, to the resources, to the housing, to the healthcare, such that they can do this advocacy work. Because so often many trans people of color are just trying to survive and aren't able to, you know, be part of these organizations. And so we create this awful and perverse dynamic where these are the communities that are served, but they're not the communities that are leading. And we need to actually challenge that and think, how do we build the leadership of people who are most directly impacted? And then I think the third and final thing I would say about that is we need to really think about the politics of representation. So whenever we are creating images, if we are designing flyers, if we are speaking about our organization, are we exclusively putting white faces and white voices as the authors of this? Because then that ends up reproducing this idea that the only people who can be legitimately trans are white. So just being really intentional at every level to make sure that Black and brown folks and Indigenous folks are represented, heeded, and given opportunities for leadership.
All right, thank you. So another question I have is, what's been on your mind lately in 2020? Like, what is your work doing? What are you thinking about?
I've been experiencing a lot of despair in 2020 because in this short time, there's just been so much from what's happening in Australia with the wildfires to the spread of the coronavirus to the status of the selection. It can feel really defeating and disheartening because all accounts lead to the fact of like global economic, financial, social, political, climate collapse. And we still have so many governments who are just completely refusing to catch up to the reality of this world, and I think that's deeply irresponsible. And so I've been really thinking about how do I turn that despair into something else, because despair often immobilizes me and makes me feel like I can't do anything. And so what I've been telling people is, what if we elected our friends as our presidents? Meaning, what if we treated our communities not just as constituents, as governments, but as autonomous forms of government to begin with? And what if we invested and rooted and supported our friends and communities with the same deep conviction that we do and are supposed to for oftentimes these governments that don't care about us? And what that looks like for me is deepening our relationships with one another, so that we have systems of support during times of crisis, and we have systems of mutual aid. So I'm thinking around coronavirus, so many folks are going to be struggling if they have to quarantine to have adequate food or childcare or make enough money if they're day workers, rather than hoping. I mean, obviously we should be advocating for the government to have relief of these things, of course, but at the same time, we should also be strategizing how we can raise resources as communities so that people who are most vulnerable won't be affected. Like, I've been really inspired by how in Seattle I saw an artist that created a fund for cultural workers and artists who are going to have to cancel all their engagements because of the virus. Because oftentimes cultural workers have public-facing careers that are based off of public events, and as that becomes harder and harder, they're going to lose opportunities for income. And I was like, yeah, like, that's awesome. I just really believe in mutual aid.
I'm butting in here to add that Denver actually has an equivalent inspired by Seattle's fund, and you can find it by Googling Denver Metro Artist Relief Fund GoFundMe.
And I think that I'm trying to turn that despair into a commitment to mutual aid.
The inverse, what are some things, I guess you already mentioned one, but what are some things that are currently bringing you joy?
Every day I'm listening to one or two podcasts that are interviews with people that I admire, a lot of whom are artists. And that kind of quiet intimacy of just being able to like listen and like take notes on my iPhone notes app that I have like a zillion of those now, of just quotes that I hear all over the place, has given me so much clarity and conviction that I'm part of something greater than myself. Like, I was listening to an incredible interview with an incredible luminary Black feminist elder poet a couple of days ago, and she had this quote, Nikki Giovanni, this quote that said, I am 25. She wrote this when she was 25 years old. I am 25. I am a revolutionary poet. I love. And I was just so happy to hear her say that and to read that quote. She's 74 when she did this interview. Because she was explaining, what does that third line mean, I love, and how is that related to I'm a revolutionary poet? And I just felt like I was part of a legacy. And I think feeling like you're part of a legacy is part of what I was saying earlier about permission to existence and permission to legitimacy. Legacy links to our sense of legitimacy, which makes me feel more grounded.
The last question I have is that usually I put like a song at the end of the show. Is there any song that you're really appreciating right now that you think would be fitting for this?
Totally. So on with my obsession with pop culture, I've been really jamming to Demi Lovato's new single, I Love Me. And I just think it's actually like a really important feminist queer intervention, actually. Because what she's really doing in this is like, for the corpus of her career, a lot of her songs were about like, I need your love. And in this song, she's just basically being like, I'm enough. And I'm a 10 out of 10. And I think that it's so cliche and so simple, but I Am Enough is, I think, one of the most profound poems ever written. And this song, for me, really encapsulates that.
Flipping through all of these magazines, telling me who I'm supposed to be. Way too good at camouflage. Can't see what I am, I just see what I'm not. I'm guilty about everything that I eat. Feeling myself as a felony. Jedi level sabotage. Voices in my head make up my entourage. 'Cause I'm a black belt when I'm beating up on myself.
Well, that's all the questions I have. Is there anything that you want to share with us? Anything that you wish I'd asked you?
I guess I just want to share like my love and support to the trans and gender non-conforming community in Colorado. I've been coming to Colorado for many years now. I think it's been like 6 or 7, and I'm always just so impressed by how kind and generous and powerful and interdependent people are. But I can't underestimate the forms of like profound invalidation and violence that we're experiencing under this administration. So I just want to affirm all of y'all for like existing and being, and I'm really hoping that we create a country and a world that affirms us and sincere us.
Well, thank you so much. I so appreciate you being willing to speak to me today and speak to all of us.
Why do I compare myself to everyone? And I always got my finger on the self-destruct. I wonder when I love me is enough.
You've been listening to Outsources on KDNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm Yvonne Crumry, and I've been speaking with our guest, Alok, who's a performance artist and writer, about the things that bring them joy in this time of isolation, as well as their new book, Beyond the Gender Binary, and their work in redefining the beauty industry. You can find Alok on Instagram, which has a wealth of their work, so check it out, at ALOKVMENON. As always, you can find this and other Outsources shows at news.kgnu.org/outsources. Tune in next Monday at 6:30 for another episode of Outsources on KGNU, bringing you homegrown queer radio in the state of Colorado.